Last year, the writer George Packer published a book about the cantankerous but brilliant diplomat Richard Holbrooke, whose death was as dramatic as his life. His aorta burst in the office of Hillary Clinton in 2010. And there's a connection between the way Holbrooke thought about America and the way Packer has been thinking about the country right now, in the middle of an election year while contending with a global pandemic. Packer tells this story in the book about Holbrooke going with his wife to see a revival of the 1949 Broadway musical South Pacific. The play got Holbrooke thinking and comparing the America of the moment to the America in those years after World War II, and how the country, he said, had lost confidence in its own ability to lead.
In the summer of 2010, Holbrooke was 69 years old and was in the very last months of his life.
It was a fantastic night, afternoon in the theater, maybe the best ever.
And Holbrooke recorded in this audio diary that he kept at key moments of his life, including in these last months of his life, his reaction, which was overwhelming emotion.
Men were crying, myself included.
This is a man who did not cry, who tried not to show any extreme emotion other than maybe anger. But he was weeping. And he tried to understand why it had had this effect on him, why it had made him and other men around him weep.
For me, it was the combination of the beauty of the show and its music and the capturing in that show of so many moments in American history. The theme, Americans at war in a distant land, the sense of loss of American optimism and our feeling that we could do anything.
We saved the world from fascism. We saved Europe from starvation after the war. We created NATO. We created the United Nations. We held off communism for the half century of the Cold War. And for Holbrooke, who was born in 1941, that very year that we entered World War II, this was the America of his youth and of his imagination, and he never let go of it. That was always his idea of who we were. We were the country that had to lead and that we alone could solve the most pressing and intractable problems of the world. And that with all of our clumsiness and arrogance and our grievous mistakes, we still were a benevolent power and that we would do more good than harm by going out into the world and solving problems. And I think the emotion was mainly that this is over.
Contrast with today. It was very powerful. And I kept thinking of where we were today, our nation, our lack of confidence in our own ability to lead compared to where we were in 1949.
He realized this era is over. We are no longer that power. We no longer have that confidence and that optimism and that innocence. And the world no longer looks to us for leadership. That realization was, in a way, heartbreaking for Richard Holbrooke. His whole life was premised on the idea that America was the indispensable country and that, in a sense, he would be the indispensable American. And the sun was setting on that world and that time.
This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
Oh my God, another plane has just hit, it hit another building, flew right into the middle of it. Explosion.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend. Lehman Brothers, a 158-year-old firm.
This would be a really alien and upsetting time for Richard Holbrooke, and I'm not sure he would know exactly how to get out of it.
Our lives matter. Black lives matter.
Black lives matter. Black lives matter.
I am officially running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
Can Donald Trump win a general election?
My view is no, but we'll see.
Build that wall. Build that wall. Build that wall.
He would find the rhetoric of America first, not just wrong, but perverse, like a waste of our influence and self-destructive.
CNN projects Donald Trump wins the presidency. The business tycoon and TV person.
Former FBI Director Robert Mueller is coming in to investigate the Trump campaign.
Tonight's vote in the full House of Representatives makes Donald Trump just the third American president to be impeached.
There was no collusion with Russia.
China has identified the cause of the mysterious pneumonia outbreak in Wuhan City, and it's from the same family that caused the deadly SARS epidemic 17 years ago. It's a new type of coronavirus.
Coronavirus officially hitting the U.S. Here's what we know.
I can't help but think, how would Richard Holbrooke have acted in the face of this global crisis?
New Yorkers should be prepared right now for the possibility of a shelter-in-place order.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat.
The New York Times paid tribute to the victims of coronavirus, printing the names of 1,000 in their Sunday edition. That's just 1% of the nearly 100,000 people lost in America's latest war.
It's not as though Donald Trump single-handedly ended the American century. This is a long tectonic shift that's been going on maybe for two decades. In a way, Trump is more of a reaction to it, a symptom of it. It's not something that you can necessarily reverse by willing it, since I think history has taken a turn that maybe was inevitable, but that now seems irreversible.
To the most distant corners of the globe and saved civilization.
You never can go back. You can't go back to 1949 or 1942. All you can do is try to find the best way through the new era, which is what we're in now.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. George Packer is joining us today for a wide-ranging discussion that involved Richard Holbrooke, Christopher Hitchens, Donald Trump. Packer's been doing a lot of writing lately about the current moment, how leaders and Americans have been reacting to this pandemic. The title of his most recent essay for The Atlantic may give away his state of mind. It's called "We Are Living in a Failed State." And he told us the last few months have brought up a lot of emotions, mostly rage.
I was so angry at our leaders, and let's name names. I was particularly angry at President Trump, but also at others in Congress and in the White House and around the government. And I was angry at China, too. I mean, they negligence and short-sightedness and lying have unleashed on the world an unbelievable tragedy that is affecting the entire world. And although the virus is a biological fact that we don't think and pretty certain was not created by human beings, its spread has been enabled by human beings. It didn't have to happen. So I was just furious at the Trump seeing everything in personal terms and as his own interest, and whether his own interest could be. This goes back to Holbrooke a bit. Holbrooke was, you know, had an ego to rival anyone's, but it was always invested in some larger purpose. It wasn't just, I'm going to get this out of it. I'm going to become Secretary of State. I'm going to get rich. It always had to have some larger purpose for it to be satisfying to him. Whereas with Trump, you have the feeling his ego is a thing in itself, and his sense of self-interest is cut off from the interest of every other human being on earth. And that's such a destructive psychological position from which to be in charge during a crisis. So I was just angry, but I was also thinking about what this was revealing. It was showing us something in ourselves that maybe we suspected but didn't know for sure, like a stress test or like a virus that finds you out and lets you know what the state of your health is. It was a pretty obvious analogy to me. And the state of our health as a country has been getting worse for years now. So the virus had a field day with us because it turned out we don't trust our government. We don't trust one another. We don't trust experts. We don't have a social safety net that can catch people when something like this destroys their life. All sorts of ways in which our institutions have been decaying were suddenly right in our face because our lives depended on them and we couldn't count on them.
One of the things you write in the essay is that the crisis demanded a response that was, this is how you put it, swift, rational, but also collective. And I wanted to key on that phrase for a moment. You said it demanded a collective response. Talk about that if you would, because one of the things you mention in the article is that this COVID-19 crisis is actually the third crisis of the 21st century that America has had to deal with. And you make this comparison in the piece. Like in 9/11, for example, you mentioned being the first of that crisis. And you say that then there was still enough, goodwill and a collective memory about making it through tougher times together that was in place that's just not here. Would you talk a little bit about the comparison you make there?
Right. I think it's only been two decades in this century, but we have been hit by more than the usual number of really big, difficult events. And 9/11 was the first. I was in New York that day and the days after, and my overwhelming feeling was that the country rallied behind New York City and saw New York as an American city that had taken a hit for the rest of the country and that needed the help of the rest of the country and the support and the love. And it came. It was overwhelming. I remember running into some firefighters who'd driven overnight from Indiana in order to try to help out at Ground Zero. That's not the America we're living in right now. And the reaction to the pandemic has broken down along partisan lines in a way that was perhaps inevitable, but that also makes no sense whatsoever. How is it that If you're a red voter, you don't need to wear a mask. And if you're a blue voter, you do need to wear a mask. How is it that wearing a mask has become a political symbol when we're all human and therefore we're all vulnerable to the coronavirus? So it makes less and less sense because the virus is truly the kind of attack that shows us how connected we all are, how much we need each other. If you can't see it now, you can never see it. And yet, partly because we have some terrible leaders, Americans are being pushed back into the tribes, back into the tribal responses. And I think it's going to be even more tragedy because we don't have a national plan. No one knows what to do. Everyone has to improvise, state by state, town by town. And that's not going to work because the virus doesn't care about states and towns. So yeah, that 9/11 did begin, I think, some of the divisions. And the other crisis, 2008, the financial crisis, deepened them because it seemed as if some people got away with it and other people paid the price. And it sort of led to real cynicism about government and big banks and institutions. And it led to the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. It drove people toward extremes. This is now the third, and it's taking place in the context of we are already now a Balkanized country, and we're seeing how dangerous it is to be Balkanized like this when you've got a threat to all of us that we need to cooperate with each other in order to try to contain. We have not done a good job.
It's interesting how you say how we're the country sort of where we shake out now after all of this in this moment. You say a third of the country locked itself into a hall of mirrors that it believed to be reality. A third drove itself mad with the effort to hold on to the idea of knowable truth. A third just gave up trying.
Well, we have been living with alternative facts for several years now coming directly from the top. That is to say, an unbroken stream of lies, conspiracy theories, misinformation, which has divided us even more because it's now not just that one person is for gun control and another is against it. It's that one person lives in a world in which the facts about guns are one thing and another person has completely different facts about guns or about global warming or about the coronavirus. And Trump has been, as I say in that essay, like a boy tossing matches in a dry field because that the, you know, the vulnerability of the country to being divided, you know, by facts or by lies is so great now that all he has to do is tweet, you know, that the governor of Michigan is part of a conspiracy to destroy the economy so that he won't get reelected. And a lot of people are going to start believing that and thinking that she's wicked. And I have this sense that the more information we have at our fingertips on the internet, social media, the less we really know.
It's interesting. One of the things that you make this comparison that I wanted to ask you about with Donald Trump and his leadership at this particular moment and the French general who signed an armistice with Germany, formed the Vichy regime, the pro-Nazi Vichy regime during World War II. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's interesting to compare this moment to how other leaders and other moments in history. It's something you do from time to time.
It occurred to me when Trump began to say he was a wartime president, which I think was one of his many pivots. Yeah. After dismissing the virus, he then said, this is a war and I'm a wartime president. I think he's moved on several stages beyond that. But back when he was a wartime president and this was a war, I was thinking about France in 1940 when it wasn't just that the German armies swept across the Maginot Line and were in Paris within a few weeks. It wasn't just a military defeat. It was the collapse of a society. France had been in some ways rotting from within in the decades since World War I. And it didn't take all that much for it to collapse. It wasn't just, you know, more tanks. It was its own will to fight was gone. And Marshal Pétain, who took over the negotiations and negotiated the ceasefire with Hitler and then created the Vichy regime. He had been the hero of World War I, but he also represented this decay. And I felt that something like that has happened here. It's as if we've given up this fight. Why aren't we fighting this harder? Why aren't we in it together, making sure that by September, we have the ability to get kids back to school and get people back to work? Who does that make Donald Trump? To me, it makes him not a tyrant, but a very weak leader who has acquiesced, in a sense, who has collaborated with the enemy. If it's a war, he's a collaborator.
Do you get to this question? It's like you sort of synthesize all of these things that you're working through to this question. Do we trust our leaders and one another enough to summon this collective response? Would you sort of take me through that, the thinking of that question? Because there are a few questions there. Do we trust leaders? Do we trust one another? And then you also ask in the essay, are we still capable of self-government? Talk about that if you would.
Because for me, this is the key to America. What is it that holds this huge, raucous, wildly diverse country together? And it's not religion, it's not blood and soil, and it's not some ancient cultural memory. It's self-government, the idea of that every government must have the consent of the governed and the participation of the governed. And in that sense, we are responsible for ourselves. And that is, I think that is a deep American idea. And you see it not just in, you know, elections and in Congress in Washington, but in the way people lead their lives, that they have to be responsible for themselves. And it requires a degree of trust because we are not individual atoms unconnected to others. Self-government requires us to delegate powers, to trust different branches of government to do what they are supposed to do and no more, to trust the courts, Congress, and our fellow citizens to make rational decisions and to be of goodwill, in a sense, to want the best for all of us. And that's been eroding for most of my adult life and very rapidly in the last few years. And now with the pandemic, as I don't want to be too bleak, there have been good things that we see every day in our communities and some polling that's somewhat hopeful, because it does turn out that most Americans are following the guidelines and the rules in order to keep themselves and others safe. But it still looks pretty ugly. And it leads to that question of, I mean, if the state of Wisconsin, you know, can't decide who gets to say that businesses are opening up, and meanwhile, who gets to say whether Wisconsinites have to go vote or not, if that becomes a big partisan fight up to the last minute, leading to lots of anger and ill will, that's a real question about whether we still have that cohesion to make decisions together and carry them out for the greater good.
George Packer, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic. His book is Our Man, Richard Holbrooke and the End of the American Century. We've been also talking about this article, which is in the newest edition of The Atlantic. It's called We Are Living in a Failed State. We'll have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Cars are an important part of everyday life until they break down and just take up space in the driveway. If you can't drive an old vehicle, why not donate it to support KUER? We'll come pick it up for free, and you could receive a tax deduction. It's an easy and convenient way to support the informative, engaging public radio programs that you trust. Learn more about making a vehicle donation at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer George Packer, who's been doing a lot of writing lately about the current moment, the Trump administration, and the rest of the country's reaction to this pandemic. He has a new piece in The Atlantic that we're talking about. It's how the coronavirus revealed what was already broken in American society. The piece is called "We Are Living in a Failed State." In 2019, you won the Hitchens Prize. And there was in your acceptance speech, it was adapted in an essay in The Atlantic, and I wanted to talk to you about some of these moments. But first, could we begin with your relationship with Christopher Hitchens? You were friends, but also, let me put it this way. You were decent to each other, good friends in person, but could be brutal in print. You had a decent little rivalry going there as well.
Well, I think, I didn't feel like his peer. He was older than me, and he was far better known and far more prolific. So I didn't see him as either a rival or a close friend, but I respected him. Yeah. And I think he respected me, but he also, as the whole world knows, was unbelievably combative. And so he would give a quote to a paper and take a shot at me because I was being critical of the way the Iraq war was going. We had actually both supported it in different degrees of public, support and of passionate support. I was far more ambivalent. He was far more of a crusader, but there were many friendships that ended over small degrees of difference in those years. And with Hitchens, a small degree of difference would lead to a really nasty spat in print. But then I would see him by chance a few months later and he'd be, "Let's go have a drink. It's good to see you. What have you been working on?" And it was as if nothing had ever happened. Yeah. And what that said to me was, for him, politics and literature and intellectual combat, they were what he lived for, but they weren't the whole of life. Mm. And friendship and drinking together and sharing enthusiasms, like for George Orwell, who we both love, you don't want to lose that just because of a deep political disagreement. And I don't know, there was something restrained and decent about that that I liked.
Well, the reason I was interested in this is I wanted to get your impressions of what it's like to write about a moment like this. Because you say in that essay that this current atmosphere is inhospitable to the spirit of Hitchens' writing. So I wanted you to explain what you meant by that, because you explore what you say are some of the enemies of writing. And one of them is this idea of belonging. Belonging is an enemy to writing. Work me through that, if you would.
In the last few years, partly because of social media, especially Twitter, and maybe because of the financial peril of journalism, and because of the political climate, it's very hard just to be a writer and to be writing for yourself and for your audience out of your own experience, your own mind, your own reporting. People want to know which side you're on and what right you have
to say what you're saying. And if you're this identity or this political tendency, it's as if they already know what they think of you. That's all that, that's all some readers want to know. Then their mind is made up and it closes. Whereas Hitchens and Orwell, who was such an influence on Hitchens, stood for the idea that you are speaking for yourself only and that you should be willing to stand alone. There's no shame in that. In fact, there's something honorable in going against the crowd if the crowd seems to have lost its head. Whereas today, you know, your status is somehow counted by the number of your Twitter followers. It can actually be quantified. I would say if you haven't been vilified on Twitter, then maybe there's something wrong with your writing. Maybe you're not telling hard enough truths or being honest enough or being willing to say things that people are not supposed to say. So it was just a bit of a lament that the idea of the writer as someone who just speaks out of conscience and the self, but always trying to reach an audience, and not just a tribal audience, everyone, to speak to everyone, as if we all could understand and be understood if only we tried hard enough and marshaled enough facts and enough rhetoric and enough persuasive power, then we could actually begin to have a conversation.
So when you taught a journalism course at Yale last year, so what were you seeing in your students? Because one of the things you mentioned is they kept running into this problem. They wanted to write. They wanted to have a kind of moral certainty as a basis.
I think they were uneasy approaching a subject about which they had not made up their minds, about which they didn't know what sort of the right approach, the right thought was. They were it's not as though they were just, you know, automatons. These were really smart, resourceful, and very open-minded kids. It was not like the Red Guard. they were really promising, all of them. And I wanted them to be able to fulfill their promise as much as possible. And one way I wanted to do that was to prod them to write about things that might get them in trouble, or about which they might find out that their thoughts were not what they had expected to find after digging deep. And, you know, I think they both understood why I was doing that and also sort of distrusted it or were a little afraid of it because, again, where might that land me? Where are you pushing me that I might end up a pariah among my classmates or on Twitter? They're living in a different world from the one I grew up in and became a writer in. And it feels, although there are many, many more platforms and many more ways in which you can make your voice heard, there's also a very high price to be paid if you make your voice heard and it's not what the crowd wants.
George Packer, I want to shift back to Richard Holbrook if we could. One of the things you've talked about in the book, you mention, like, I'm trying to imagine, as we were talking about earlier, what Richard Holbrooke would think or make of this. I mean, he saw his share of foreign policy debacles, how he would have put this one, you know, in this particular incident in perspective. And one of the things that you mention is that he had this sense of character. That sometimes, you'll have to correct me on this, but he said, we only have about 2% of the information at any given time. So in some ways, these really crucial decisions that you have to make have to come down to something more, less tangible, more abstract, like character, I guess. Would you talk about that?
Yes, that's a very good quote for you to pick out because it's sort of his MO in foreign policy. It's not a game of chess. It's certainly not a math problem. It's a really messy human drama in which the people with power are making huge decisions that will change history, and they don't really know much. Things are moving too fast. They're too insulated. They're too busy. The people who really know this stuff are too low down in the bureaucracy to really get the information to where it needs to go. So all these factors mean that a president or a secretary of state will have to rely on his or her character and judgment and experience for so much. And that is truly evident right now, where even though a lot of experts misjudged or underestimated the coronavirus, a better leader, a better person than Trump would have said, let's err on the side of caution. That's a judgment call, and it's a matter of the character of the person making the call. And I think Richard Holbrooke, for all his flaws, cared about what he was doing. He cared about the people whose lives he was influencing with his decisions. So I think Holbrooke would have advised, let's not risk it. Let's pretend that this could be the once in a century epidemic. He saw HIV/AIDS as a national security risk and put it in front of the UN Security Council when he was President Clinton's UN ambassador. First time a disease had ever been addressed by the UN Security Council, because he had seen the ravages of it in Africa and knew that it needed the cooperation of the world powers.
I'd really love to bring people's attention to the book, Our Man. Could you talk a little bit about the way you wrote it? Because I think this is really important for people thinking about, you know, there's a lot of biographies out there, and this is not what you wanted for this book. In fact,
no.
I love how you described it as you wanted it to be more like a vintage movie in some ways. And also the way – just talk about also the narrator, who isn't exactly you, sort of you, but not really you, and the way it's – the way you structured it and the way you wrote it. I wanted you to say something about that.
Thank you for asking, because this is something I really like talking about. The first lines of the book are, Holbrooke, yes, I knew him. I can't get his voice out of my head.
Yeah.
So you're already, first of all, in a direct relation to the narrator. He's talking to you, the reader, and there's a lot of second person you in the book where the narrator is speaking as if you're in the same room. My idea was, this should not be some kind of objective monument that people buy and don't read to a man that they think maybe was important, but they don't quite know why. This should be a novel or an old movie with a voiceover. And it should, if it's a novel, it should be a Conradian novel or a Graham Greene-like novel where you have a narrator who knows the main character. So I had to kind of invent. Nothing is invented in the book, of course. It's all scrupulous, and there's 30 pages of notes at the end. But the voice of the narrator is an invention, because in order to tell the story like a yarn over a long night, I needed a narrator who somehow knew Holbrooke and knew the whole story without ever telling you quite how. It's as if you're hearing from some distant friend of his, or someone who followed his career from a slight distance and who's telling you about it in great detail with a lot of intimacy, but without ever explaining where the facts come from.
Yeah.
And so in that way, I'd hope the voice would make it more alive, more intimate and present, so that Holbrooke, who is such a big character, so funny and crazy and unhousebroken for a diplomat, that character would overflow the pages and not be too confined by the traditional respectful, distant tone of a biography. It should really read more like a novel about a character who you can't stop looking at because you just want to know what he's going to do next.
Was taken by the physical description you give early on in the book. Strangely small head, long, skinny limbs. You write about his feet, he had this problem throughout his life. They would swell up and become marbled. You say it's like a steak. Would you just talk a little bit about sort of those descriptions? Because it seems like those are really critical about the way you wanted to give us a real sense of who he was.
Yeah, so the first two pages are about his voice, his feet, and his eyes.
Yeah.
And I wanted to bring him right in front of the reader so that you're seeing him, again, like a figure on screen. You're that close to him. There's nothing remote or abstract about him. He is as concrete as his feet. And I go on about his feet for quite a while because Everyone I interviewed had something to say about his feet. It came up again and again that he had trouble with them. He would take his shoes and socks off and put his feet up in your face while he was talking to you. And he was he would sweat his way through six pairs of socks a day. There was some circulatory problem with the feet, and that they ended up looking marbled red and white like steak. And that to me was like, this is the feet of clay. This is the fallenness of him. What's human about him? His flaws, his weaknesses. The feet are dragging him down. But then the eyes at the other end of his body are these crystalline blue piercing lights coming at you. So alert, so intelligent, and they kind of capture you and don't let you go. And you can imagine those eyes sitting across the table from Slobodan Milosevic of Serbia during the Balkan Wars, negotiating the end of the war in Bosnia, which is what Holbrooke, that was his greatest achievement. And just the intelligence that captured this thug and wouldn't let him go. So I just wanted all of Holbrooke in some ways to kind of come down to those physical features in order for him to become a character and for the reader to not want to stop turning the pages.
I think his eyes were interesting to me because on one hand, as you said, they were on perpetual alert. But then by the same token, so much thought, you say, but so little inwardness, his lack of self-awareness. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that because that seems really interesting. It seems like, I don't know if it's his tragic flaw, but it certainly was something that people took note of. He didn't seem to be self-aware, even though he was keenly aware of other things outwardly, I guess.
I think it was his tragic flaw. I think in the end, in some ways it killed him because, yeah, you're absolutely right. He could not see himself. He could not look hard at his failings and understand what they were about. Why had he never become Secretary of State when everyone thought that he was going to get it or should have gotten it? And when he thought he should have gotten it, it was because he alienated people. He couldn't contain himself. His ambitions were out of control and were obvious. But at the end, Holbrooke was working for Barack Obama, who really couldn't stand him, who found him overbearing and long-winded and flattering and pontificating. Everything, you know, that no drama Obama couldn't bear was there in Richard Holbrooke. And so he kind of cut him off. Even though he made Holbrooke his point man on Afghanistan, he didn't give him his support or his trust. And Holbrooke knew this, but he could not understand why. And it was because he couldn't see the effect he was having on Obama. He couldn't stop doing it. And so in a way, that blindness to himself was his undoing. It was really, it broke his heart that he couldn't win over this president he admired so much, Barack Obama.
This part of the story of Richard Holbrooke kind of made me sad. It was in the end, as you say, he was still, when he died so dramatically, as you lay out in the book, basically in Hillary Clinton's office, as you said, that he – could he have solved Afghanistan? You asked that question. You say probably not. You're not sure because you say the best ideas are useless without this ability to bring them into the world, and that Holbrooke had lost this knack for persuasion. And you also say that all of this accumulated experience that he had you say we Americans don't want it. We're almost embarrassed by it. What did you mean by that?
Holbrooke began his career under John F. Kennedy. He served under every Democratic president between Kennedy and Obama. He was right in the thick of three major wars of those decades, Vietnam, Bosnia, Afghanistan. He traveled the world. He knew so much and so many people. And yet, in the end, Obama didn't really want to hear about it. Holbrooke kept trying to bring up Vietnam and to warn Obama that Afghanistan had all these eerie resemblances and that the ghost of Lyndon Johnson was haunting the Situation Room. And this was not what Obama wanted to hear. And Obama told people like Hillary Clinton to tell Holbrooke, just shut up about Vietnam. It's irrelevant. I can understand him wanting to say shut up about Vietnam because it was a lecture coming his way.
Yeah.
But it's irrelevant. I can't understand. And that has something to do, I think, with our American aversion to history, to looking at the past, to seeing ourselves as part of history and part of the world and not untouched, not exceptional, not exempted. Instead, we want to think that by coming up with the right policy and being our good selves, we will solve the problem. And instead, there's so much to learn from the past, and Holbrooke knew that. He really believed, he read history deeply, he knew a lot, and he could not get the attention of Barack Obama, partly because he was making himself unbearable. But it was tragic that those two men couldn't work together, because I think Holbrooke had things to tell Obama that Obama could have benefited from.
George Packer, finally, let's come back to the essay, your latest essay in The Atlantic. I wanted to ask you about something you mentioned. You need to talk about in the piece how the scale of the lack of a response has shocked Americans. And I guess the question is, do you think that's going to urge some kind of transformation? Because you say 2020 should kill off the idea that anti-politics is our salvation. But will it? I guess, because I've heard you say it matters a lot whether we get a second Trump term, that two terms is a permanent change, and maybe even then, who knows?
I do think that if Trump is reelected, it will mark a permanent change in our democracy. We will not come back from it. We will not recover from it. We will move on, but in a direction that I don't want us to go. And grievously damaged. But one term has been long enough and damaging enough. I don't know whether we will face the truth about ourselves this year and realize how much we need to rebuild. I can't say. But I do think that this pandemic, if it has any redeeming value, and that's saying, that's asking a lot, because the suffering has been so massive and continues to be. If it has any redeeming value, it will be that it holds a mirror up to us and forces us to look at ourselves and to say, we can't go on like this. We can't coast on the wealth and power of the past. We can't imagine that our constitutional democracy is just going to go on like a ever-ready battery and never quit. These things are all fragile, and we have to begin to do some really serious work of rebuilding. And there's a lot of different elements to what that might be, and I don't really want to prescribe them, but I do think that this year is a crucial turning point, for better or worse. And it's in a weird way an opportunity to start getting things right.
George Packer, thank you very much.
I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you, Doug.
It's George Packer. His book about the American diplomat Richard Holbrooke came out last year. It's called Our Man. And his article, We Are Living in a Failed State, appears in the latest issue of The Atlantic Magazine. We'll put a link to that on our website, RadioWest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.